Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
He would appear in the dark.
Handing, literally handing.
He was a killer.
World of Secrets, Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Listen now, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 11th of July, these are our main stories. President Biden has promised to defend every inch of NATO territory as he hosts a pivotal summit focused on countering Russian aggression in Ukraine and elsewhere. He said F-16 warplanes were on their way to Kyiv. Also, the Hollywood actor George Clooney has become the latest high-profile Democrat to urge President Biden to drop his bid for re-election. A Ugandan man has been handed a 6-year prison sentence for posts on TikTok deemed to have insulted the president and his family. Also in this podcast...
Amazing! They deserved it!
If we win that final, oh my God, everything! It means everything to all of us! It means everything to everyone!
In football, England are through to the final of the men's Euros championships after beating the Netherlands 2-1. We begin in Washington. President Biden has vowed to defend every inch of NATO territory, telling leaders of the military alliance, "We will do it together." NATO was set up 75 years ago as the dust settled after the end of the Second World War, and Western nations saw a new threat rise up in the form of the Soviet Union. Now, NATO faces one of its biggest challenges, the war in Ukraine. To those attending a summit in Washington, Mr. Biden had this to say.
For 75 years, our nations have grown and prospered behind the NATO shield. Today, we're stronger than we've ever been. Since I took office, we've doubled the number of battle groups in NATO's eastern flank, and the United States has. Finland and Sweden have joined the alliance. And the number of allies spending at least 2% on defense has gone from 9 to 23. It's not happened by chance, but by choice.
From Washington, our U.S. correspondent Tom Bateman reports now on that NATO summit.
His Excellency, Mr. Olaf Scholz, Chancellor of the Federal Republic of Germany.
Leaders from 32 countries gathered for handshakes and a welcome ceremony in Washington, where the stifling summer humidity hangs in the air with the clouds of anxiety surrounding this summit. It had opened with President Biden stressing the alliance's resolve in the face, he said, of Russian aggression and a claim that NATO has never been stronger. The alliance's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the final agreement was a show of unity.
Today, we decided to adapt NATO's command structure, improve our integrated air and missile defense systems, and to go further to match our defense plans with the necessary capabilities. All of this has been made possible by historic increases in defense investment across the alliance.
The agreement pledges what's described as a bridge to NATO membership for Ukraine, saying this will be irreversible. The language had been debated for weeks. While it is stronger than last year's text, which declared that Ukraine's future is in NATO, ultimately it still doesn't offer the kind of timetable which the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky wants. In its place, the agreement pledges at least £33 billion of military aid for Ukraine within the next year. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said deliveries of long-awaited fighter jets had started.
I'm also pleased to announce that as we speak, the transfer of F-16 jets is underway, coming from Denmark, coming from the Netherlands. And those jets will be flying in the skies of Ukraine this summer.
But Ukraine is worried about what it calls wavering leadership and the chances of a change in direction if Donald Trump is elected in November. On the margins of the summit, Mr. Zelensky has been reaching out to Republicans, invoking the memory of Ronald Reagan, a clear attempt to try to sell the case for engagement, not isolationism, among US conservatives. As well as appealing to the current president for clearer pledges, he's having to pitch the case for NATO to supporters of his rival for the White House.
Tom Bateman in Washington. Well, Joe Biden is facing a lot of scrutiny at the moment, with the Hollywood actor George Clooney, the latest Democrat, to publicly urge him to drop his bid for re-election. Mr. Biden has faced growing calls to quit after a shaky performance in a televised debate with his opponent, Donald Trump, last month. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, reports.
The roll call of Democrats asking Joe Biden to step aside keeps growing, with the first senator added to that list, and now George Clooney, who has raised millions of dollars for Mr. Biden's campaign. He writes in the New York Times that Democrats will lose in November with this president, and says that when he met Joe Biden at a big fundraiser 3 weeks ago, he appeared to be the same man we all witnessed at the debate. In a TV interview, Nancy Pelosi, the former Democratic Speaker of the House, seemed to be hinting that she too thinks the president should change his mind and agree to step aside. She was speaking to MSNBC's Jonathan Lemire.
Does he have your support to be the head of the Democratic ticket?
As long as the president has the president, it's up to the president to decide if he is going to run. We're all encouraging him to make that decision because time is running short.
He has said firmly this week he is going to run. Do you want him to run?
I want him to do whatever he decides to do. And that's the way it is. Whatever he decides, we go with.
Joe Biden does have many vocal supporters within the party, including the Democratic leaders in the House and Senate. When he's asked if he has the stamina for another 4 years in office, he often replies, "Watch me." And he'll be hoping to demonstrate his vigour as he hosts the NATO summit in Washington, knowing he is being watched very closely.
Sarah Smith. As we heard in the earlier podcast, the Israeli military have dropped leaflets over Gaza City, telling all residents to leave and warning that it is about to become a combat zone. There are estimated to be more than 250,000 people still living there. It's the second time people have been told to flee the city since the start of the conflict last October. Well, Paul Henley asked David Mensah, a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister's office, why a second evacuation of Gaza City had been necessary 9 months after the first.
Gaza's a pretty small place, and that means that Hamas fighters, the terrorists, can move around pretty quickly. And they've developed this underground terror tunnel network, which is twice the size of the London Underground. And they've developed that specifically not to defend their own people, but to move their terrorists around. Now, just today, Yoav Gallant, our defense minister, updated the Knesset, our parliament, and he said that we killed or taken off the battlefield through injury about 60% of Hamas terrorists. We think that we've eliminated about 14,000 of them. And also the majority of the 24 battalions, Hamas battalions, have been shattered. But that doesn't mean they've disappeared. Those pieces of those Hamas battalions are regrouping in different places. And wherever the IDF, the Israeli army, finds those regrouped Hamas terrorists, it's got a duty. It's got a duty to Israel's people. It's got a duty to me and my kids and my family to destroy them, to make sure that they can't carry out October the 7th ever again.
But your repeated evacuation order gives the impression to civilians that this could go on indefinitely, that the so-called fight to eliminate Hamas is infinite.
Paul, it's certainly not infinite. The Prime Minister made clear just last week that we're coming to the end of this stage, of this intensive stage of battling Hamas. We have set out three objectives for this war. That is to destroy Hamas militarily and their governing capability, to ensure we get our 120 hostages back, and also to ensure that Gaza can't be a threat to us. We don't mean that means eliminating every single Hamas terrorist, but it means breaking open their whole military ability to attack us. That's what we're doing. We think we're coming close to the end of this particular phase of this war. We don't want to be in Gaza one more day than necessary. We've got no grievance against Gaza's people, even though many of them unfortunately support Hamas. We're going after this terrorist organization. They will be defeated, but we're doing it not only to protect our own people, but we're doing it for Gazans as well, because they need to be free from this menace so they can build a better future for themselves.
You're telling people to get out via what you call designated safe routes. Are they really safe? There's a lot of evidence that nowhere in Gaza is safe at the moment.
So that's the narrative which media often put forward. But we put a lot of effort into this, very often at the expense of our own military's abilities to attack the terrorists. What we do is we try and move civilians out of harm's way. It's key to our military strategy. It's the reason why, even though one civilian death is too many, it's a reason why that this in this conflict, the Prime Minister has said that it's been about one Hamas terrorist to one civilian, which is horrible, but at least it's lower than the UN average, which is 1 to 8 or 1 to 7. We know it's traumatic to move again. It's a horrible thing to do, but we want to get them out of harm's way. We want to defeat this terrorist army, and we want to finish this war and bring our hostages home.
That was David Mensah, a spokesman for the Israeli Prime Minister's office. Well, Paul Henley also spoke to Sam Rose, Director of Planning for UNRWA, that's the UN's body in Gaza, and asked him what did he make of the Israel military's latest evacuation order for Gaza City.
We've seen a series of evacuation orders in Gaza City over the past several days, starting from the east, pushing people to the west of the city. Then they've received evacuation orders from the west of the city, pushing them further west. And now the evacuation orders that came yesterday and were reinforced today were instructing people, ordering them to evacuate south of the Wadi Gaza checkpoint, which has been in place since October and really prevented safe movement north and south. People being instructed to evacuate immediately to areas south of that checkpoint. Now, it's still early. It's an evolving situation. We have reports of several hundred families that have crossed that checkpoint. But look, the total population of northern Gaza above that checkpoint is over a quarter of a million people. Now, we're not necessarily suggesting all of these are in the evacuation areas, but there's a real potential here that we're talking large numbers of people that could be forced south.
And what do you make of the Israeli description of the routes they have to take as designated safe ones?
I spent a lot of my time yesterday dealing with a situation in an UNRWA school in central Gaza where the population that had been sheltering there were ordered to leave the school, ordered to go out into the streets and evacuate. This was a school inside the evacuation area. It was very fraught. It was a very scary situation for them because the area that they were being told to evacuate through was a hot area. It was unsafe. There were heavy bombardments. It was a military area. So very difficult for people to evacuate in these areas. And they've not been evacuated and forcibly displaced for the first time. Many, 5, 10 times they've been forced to move already. So they're already burnt out. It's hot. They've got little food, little water. So very traumatic immediately and in the longer term for people who are forced through these routes. And look, we've had many, many cases of people, including staff that I know personally, colleagues and friends who've been killed whilst evacuating. The entire Gaza Strip is essentially subject to military operations, not as hot as in some of these areas, but very difficult for anyone to move anywhere on any route that is safe right now, unfortunately.
That was Sam Rose from UNRWA speaking to the BBC from Nuseirat in central Gaza. When Brazil's president Lula da Silva came to power last year, he accused his predecessor Jair Bolsonaro of carrying out a genocide against Brazil's indigenous peoples. Well, now the leaders of those groups have asked the UN to put pressure on Lula himself to take urgent action against mining on their ancestral lands in the Amazon rainforest. Our America's editor Leonardo Rocha told me more about what they had to say.
What they said, basically, they sounded quite forceful in their statements, is that their communities, the Kayapós, the Yanomami and the Mundurukus, that their children are still dying of preventable illnesses, diseases, that they are still being attacked by thousands of illegal gold miners who are still living in their lands and basically taking gold from there and other resources as well. And they say the rivers are polluted by mercury, this highly toxic metal that's used to separate gold from the sand. So the situation hasn't changed that much. And they said the UN should put pressure on the Lula government so that he can do more.
The expectations on Lula when he came to power were so huge, weren't they? And he didn't do an awful lot to downplay those expectations. Now perhaps he's realising that it's harder to change things and turn things around when you're in power.
That's exactly the case because, of course, the Lula government, they are very committed to the indigenous causes and environmental causes. And what he said is in the first week of his government, he went to the Yanomami land and he denounced a genocide against the Yanomami. I think it's much harder to tackle illegal mining than he thought it was. He's also under pressure from a fiscal balance to balance the budgets, and there have been cuts to the government budget, including to the environment budget. And there are other complications as well, the increasing and worrying presence of criminal gangs. Now, a lot of these illegal miners are working for the PCC, it's the First Command of the Capital, is the biggest criminal gang in Brazil. So it's a lot easier to say that you're going to do than to do it, and it takes time.
And for these groups to go to Geneva, to the United Nations, and say, look, put pressure on our president to do more, that's embarrassing for Lula, isn't it?
Well, there's an embarrassment on their side as well, because they can't openly criticize Lula, or they don't want to, because they're committed, they're part of the government in a way. So it is embarrassing for Lula that he will hear that from other sources. The international media will report on that, and then they will compare, well, probably what the Lula supporters will say, well, it was much worse under Bolsonaro, who encouraged development of indigenous lands and all that. Yeah, but your expectations for the Lula government were very different, and that's what these indigenous leaders are saying now, that the people are still dying and there's still danger.
Leonardo Rocha. Next, to the US state of New Mexico. There, a court in Santa Fe has heard the first witnesses in the trial of the actor Alec Baldwin for involuntary manslaughter on the set of his film Rust. The prosecution and jury listened to testimony from a responding police officer and watched his body cam footage. During a rehearsal in 2021 on the set of the film, the cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, was killed by a bullet fired from a gun Alec Baldwin was holding as part of a scene. His defence denied any wrongdoing and blamed the weapons supervisors on set. Our Los Angeles correspondent, Emma Vardy, has been outside the court. Her report includes some of that body cam footage.
Mr. Baldwin, you feeling confident? Is this a fair trial? Returning to New Mexico, where the shooting happened, Alec Baldwin arrived to face a jury who will decide whether he was responsible.
You were in the room when that lady... I was the one
holding the gun, yeah.
Okay, alrighty.
This was the moment police arrived on set of the Western movie Rust, after a scene had gone terribly wrong.
Alec Baldwin was the actor on set that pulled the trigger.
The pistol being used by Alec Baldwin had fired a live round, killing the cinematographer, Helena Hutchins.
What's your job there with him?
I'm the armor, or at least I was.
The mystery of how live rounds ended up on the film set was revealed earlier this year.
Oh my God.
When the film's armorer, Hannah Gutierrez, stood trial for involuntary manslaughter. It was her responsibility to ensure weapons were safe. But she had mistakenly mixed up dummy rounds with real bullets.
Despite the film's armourer being convicted and sentenced to 18 months in jail, prosecutors still believe Alec Baldwin was also responsible. They're trying to prove the gun could only have been fired because of his actions.
The evidence will show that someone who played make-believe with a real gun and violated the cardinal rules of firearm safety is the defendant. Alexander Baldwin.
Alec Baldwin claims he never pulled the trigger and that it was the responsibility of other crew members to make sure the gun was safe.
Safety has to occur before the gun is placed in the actor's hands. In this case, this unique case on a movie set, the prop gun was placed in Mr. Baldwin's hands and cold gun was announced, meaning it had been checked and double-checked by those responsible to ensure the gun was safe.
All rise for the jury.
But prosecutors argue he did not follow safety protocols, which could have prevented the cinematographer's death.
Emma Vardy in New Mexico. Next to football, and England are through to the final of the Men's Euros Championship. A goal from Ollie Watkins in the dying minutes of the match in the German city of Dortmund gave England a 2-1 victory over the Netherlands. England, who lost to Italy in the final of the last Euros, will now face Spain on Sunday. This was the reaction of English fans back home.
Amazing! They deserved it!
If we win that final, oh my God, everything! It means everything to all of us! It means everything to everyone!
While watching the match with John Bennett from BBC Sport, I asked him how big a moment this is in English footballing history.
It's huge because the England men's team, they've only ever been to two major tournament finals before. 1966, the World Cup final, which they won, And then in 2021, the Euros final, which they lost to Italy, both of those finals were played in London, played at Wembley. So this is the first time that England have reached a final of a major tournament on foreign soil. And I think it's massive as well for the Gareth Southgate era. This England manager, we expect him to leave after this tournament. He's been in charge for a long time now. He's had some success, but he's been really criticised, particularly in the UK media, for the fact that this England team have been a bit boring, perhaps. Some of his substitutions haven't worked out. But I have to say, in this game, he got everything right.
Yeah, as you were saying then, in previous games this time, the victories had underwhelmed people, even though they were victories. This time it was better match, better performance.
Yeah, really good performance, particularly in the first half. The Netherlands took the lead, Xavi Simons with a fantastic goal, but England reacted well. One thing you can't question with this England team, they have real character. A debatable penalty, I would say, but Harry Kane tucked it away. And then the Netherlands made it a bit more even second half. But that moment at the end for Ollie Watkins, I think what's special about that is that Ollie Watkins has been on the sidelines for the whole tournament, really. But he gets his chance now. He stayed ready. Gareth Southgate is excellent as a man manager. He keeps all the players, even who aren't playing, he keeps them happy. He comes on and he's the hero at the end.
Meanwhile, John, on Sunday, it's a bit of a step up for England. They face Spain. They look very good indeed. It's going to be a stern test.
It's a massive test because Spain have got the results, but they've also played entertaining football. It reminds me of the teams, the Spain teams that won Euro 2008, the World Cup in 2010 and the Euros in 2012 as well. That was a tiki-taka football, lots of short passes. It's a bit like that, but it's a bit more direct now. They have two amazing wingers in Lamine Yamal and Nico Williams, so they're great to watch. I think Spain will start as the big favourites for this final, but you never know. England have real character.
John Bennett. Still to come.
This is the night mail crossing the border, bringing the cheque and the postal order. Letters for the rich, letters for the poor, the shop at the corner of the girl next door.
In Britain, Royal Mail's famous postal night train is to become a thing of the past.
He was a kind of vigilante killer.
He killed at least 19 people during the 1980s in South Africa.
Very dark times.
People were desperate. We were looking for him. We couldn't find him. And nobody knew where he was.
Every single one of his victims was black.
He reached such a stage where he was now hunting.
World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
A court in the United Arab Emirates has handed down life sentences to more than 40 political activists after finding them guilty of terror offences. United Nations experts and rights groups have severely criticised the mass trial. Here's Sally Nabil.
They were convicted of financing and founding a terrorist group that was meant to launch attacks on UAE's soil. We spoke to the daughter of one of those who have been handed down life in prison sentence, and she said that lawyers have been barred from accessing the case's files, and they haven't been able to meet their clients. So lots of legal flaws, according to the critics, that have been committed during this trial.
Sally Nabil. Well, staying in the UAE, an Irish woman who was detained by police in Dubai, charged with attempting suicide and alcohol consumption, will now be allowed to return home after an intervention by Ireland's Prime Minister. The UAE is one of few countries that still treat suicide as a crime. Ireland's Department of Foreign Affairs currently lists the country as requiring a high degree of caution, advising that there have been several arrests for kissing in public and that it's a punishable offence to be drunk in public. Our reporter, Charles Haviland, told me more about the background to the story.
Tori Toi is a woman in her 20s and she had gone to the United Arab Emirates only last year to take up residence and work as a flight attendant for Emirates Airlines. And then her life as a foreigner in Dubai clearly turned sour very quickly. The Irish Prime Minister and opposition leader have given quite a few details to Irish parliamentarians today. And what they said was that she became the victim of domestic violence, very severe domestic violence. A campaign group says that she tried to take her own life by strangulation when incidents got particularly bad. And the next thing she knew was that she was in a police station and that a charge of attempted suicide was levelled against her. Now, the UAE is one of relatively few countries where suicide and attempted suicide are still regarded as crimes. In much of the world, they used to be, but that has generally been rowed back on. She was apparently charged with that and also with alcohol consumption, and was detained, and her passport was removed, and she wasn't allowed to leave the country until the matter was resolved today by diplomacy.
I suppose this situation highlights the fact that there are a lot of foreign workers in places like Dubai, and the legal system is very different from the countries that people will have come from. And it's quite ambiguous as well, isn't it, legally, the status of whether or not you can drink alcohol.
Yeah, the alcohol laws seem to leave many people in a catch-22 situation. They were recently liberalised to allow foreigners, at least, to obtain liquor permits by applying online or going to a registered alcohol store, or to purchase alcohol in certain state-controlled stores. But at the same time, you're not allowed to drink or be under the influence of alcohol in public outside one of those licensed premises. So it could be seen that people could be quite often, quite easily trapped by this situation, because it might be several hours since they've had a drink and they might be found guilty just by dint of there being alcohol in their bloodstream. This seems to be one of the criminal charges that was levelled against Tori Towey.
Charles Haviland, now, do you deserve to be in the job you're doing? Most of us would at least like to think that we're where we are because of hard work and maybe a bit of talent. So when some people are given jobs just because of who they are, it is controversial. That's been the case in Bangladesh, where a quota system has been in place. 30% of highly sought-after civil service posts have been reserved for the children of those who fought in Bangladesh's independence war more than 50 years ago. Now, the country's top court has come one step closer to ending quotas for good. Akbar Hussain, our correspondent in Dhaka, told me about the build-up to the ruling.
Thousands of students, they have been protesting on the streets, and they have blocked roads and highways and railways, demanding the elimination of any discrimination which exists in the government jobs, because they say that under the quota system, which is a kind of discriminatory system, students or job seekers, they are being victimized. On the other hand, people who are enjoying these quota facilities, they are getting the jobs.
Disadvantaged groups, perhaps, where quotas are concerned, it's understandable. But this other group, the group who just happen to be children of those people who fought in the independence war, there can't be much sympathy for them.
Bangladesh got independence 54 years ago. So basically, quota was introduced to give some sort of benefits to the freedom fighters' son or daughter, immediate son or daughter. But now this quota is being applied for the freedom fighters' grandson. Students and job seekers, they think that if there is no quota system, then it will be open competition in the job market. So anyone is eligible for the government job. They will try for the job. They will give interviews. They will give tests. So whoever is competent, they will get the job if there is no quota. So definitely, they'll be very satisfied. But again, they believe, and it is widely believed in the country, that whatever the court decision would come up, that will depend on the government. The court will take the decision the way government wants. So that is the main problem here in the country. That's why students are still continuing their protest. They do not believe in court verdict.
Akbar Hussain. A Ugandan man has been given a 6-year prison sentence for posting videos on social media that were considered to have insulted the country's president, Yoweri Museveni. The judges also included making vulgar remarks against the president's wife and his son, who's head of the army. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
In some countries, you can insult a head of state and get away with it, but not in Uganda. The magistrate said Edward Awebwa deserved a 6-year sentence so that he would learn a lesson. President Yoweri Museveni had already been in power for around 14 years when Mr. Awebwa was born. The young TikToker is not the first Ugandan to learn the hard way that there are limits when it comes to freedom of speech in his country. 2 years ago, a writer said he'd been tortured in custody for insulting the first family, and the activist Stella Nyanzi spent time in prison after publishing a poem criticising Mr. Museveni.
Will Ross. In Britain, Royal Mail will no longer use its freight trains to transport post by rail. The company is planning to sell them and increase the numbers of deliveries made by road. Royal Mail first moved onto the rail tracks in 1830, 7 years before the reign of Queen Victoria. Then, in the 20th century, the special postal night train became famous in a poem. Our correspondent Zoe Conway has more on the severing of a historic link.
This is the night mail crossing the border, bringing the cheque and the postal order. Letters for the rich, letters for the poor, the shop at the corner of the girl next door.
W.H. Auden's poem Night Mail, written in 1936, celebrated how the night train, where posts were sorted on board overnight, was bringing communities together.
And none will hear the postman's knock without a quickening of the heart. For who can bear to feel himself forgotten?
The night trains stopped running 2 decades ago, and even in the day, rail has played an ever-diminishing role in Royal Mail deliveries. Only 3% of post now moves by rail, and whilst the company says some will be carried on the tracks, it's selling off the remainder of its freight trains. Royal Mail says it will increase the number of deliveries made by road and claims that its large electric fleet of vehicles and use of biofuel makes it the greenest delivery company in the UK.
Zoe Conway. A growing number of cities in Europe have been introducing measures to curb mass tourism. Visitors to the Italian city of Venice now have to pay a fee for a day trip. And residents in Barcelona in Spain got so fed up with tourists that they started spraying them with water pistols recently. Now, Greece has brought in regulations to limit the areas on beaches that bars and restaurants can use. They're intended to leave enough space for the public who have complained about exorbitant prices charged by beachfront businesses that restrict their free access. Mark Lowen reports.
Ah, a Greek summer. Island hopping, ouzo at sunset, and often a scramble to find a patch of sand to lay your towel amid sunbeds that cost the earth. But now Greece is cracking down on beach hoggers, issuing new rules for seafront businesses. Their tables and sunbeds must be at least 4 metres away from the water to leave free space for the public, and they won't be allowed on smaller beaches. The government has issued more than €350,000 of fines in the past week for illegal beach concessions, using drones and satellites to spot offenders and launching an app for people to lodge complaints. It comes after locals formed a so-called towel movement to protest against current practice. One of its members, Tassos Telolu, spoke from the golden sands of Paros Island.
We're just my family in a beach, and we put our towel down and our umbrella, and we said, okay, this place is reserved by us. We know our rights, and we're going to stay here. They don't like it, but they have to accept it. The beach is a public space, like a square or like a street. It belongs to everybody.
Do you feel you will be helped by the new regulations?
Yes, if they are implemented.
That will be the challenge, policing Greece's thousands of miles of beaches and confronting businesses that are charged high rentals by the state. Freeing up sand for the sunseekers will require a sea change in mentalities.
Mark Lowen. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Fox. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
He was
is a kind of vigilante killer.
He killed at least 19 people during the 1980s in South Africa.
Very dark times.
People were desperate. We were looking for him. We couldn't find him. And nobody knew where he was.
Every single one of his victims was black.
He reached such a stage where he was now hunting.
World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 3, The Apartheid Killer. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.